You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 22nd of July, 2019. And you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. Well, I am very pleased to say that I have my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring with me today. Max, how are you doing today?
Yes, I'm doing very well indeed. Yes, it's been a good weekend. I've filled most of my weekend doing DIY, actually. I've just sort of done a number of long overdue repairs around the house, and so I'm feeling quite pleased with myself.
Excellent, excellent. We do like to be productive and creative and get things done. And I was just thinking then, oh, well, it's the date. It's the 22nd of July. We're actually recording this the day before, because on the 22nd of July, on the Monday when you're hearing this, we will know who the new Prime Minister of Great Britain is going to be. And of course, we all think it's going to be Boris Johnson. But today on the Sunday, we've heard that the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, has resigned, which of course the BBC think is absolutely terrible. They're all talking about what a wonderful Chancellor he was. And he's absolutely dreadful. He's a real project fear merchant. He's a total Remainer. And he's leaving before Boris pushes him out, really. And they're saying that there are going to be other cabinet ministers that are going to resign before Boris pushes them. And they're all talking about how they may even properly resign so that, the government no longer has a majority. These people are so treacherous to the nation that they would stab their own party in the back just to prevent Brexit from happening. We've also got other members of parliament saying that if Boris prorogues parliament, they're going to set up another one. They put a bill through, I think, last week, trying to prevent Boris from actually proroguing parliament. They're doing all they can to prevent him from being able to leave on October the 31st, which is absolutely, absolutely shocking. And I think in some instances, they would prefer to have Jeremy Corbyn leading the country rather than actually leave the EU. That's the way that it seems to me, anyway. But I do think it's a good sign that Hammond is resigning, and I have heard that maybe Jacob Rees-Mogg will be put in there as the Chancellor of the Exchequer. I think that would be a very good call. And obviously, I'd like to see Amber Rudd. She needs to be kicked out. We need a new foreign minister. We need some proper conservatives in there. And we'll find all this sort of stuff out, I guess, as the week goes on. And also we'll get a confirmation that Boris Johnson is in there. What do you think of this Phil Hammond chap and him resigning, Max?
Well, I think this is all very petty. And what it really indicates is that these people very often have got petty grievances amongst themselves, which they value more highly than their service to the nation. You know, if Philip Hammond felt that his position as Chancellor was vital for the financial well-being of the nation, then he shouldn't let the fact that he disagrees with Boris Johnson cause him to resign. And the same goes for the other politicians, really. They ought to have a far greater desire to serve the nation than they have to exercise the their own kind of rivalries and petty grievances. I think that it's really sad, though, that that this talk, as you've mentioned, of all sorts of things that are being all sorts of plans that are being put in place in order to frustrate Boris Johnson and to prevent him from being able to govern properly. And these are all very reminiscent of the same kind of things that have been put in place to make Donald Trump's his presidency far more difficult than it needs to be, where we've had the opposition, the Democratic Party, and all of their various hangers-on, etc., all doing everything they possibly can, all putting every possible impediment in the way of the president to prevent him from doing the things that he promised to do and which he was elected to do. In the same way, Boris Johnson has adopted a platform where he intends to follow through on the government's promise with regard to Brexit, and here we have the opposition and various members of his own party putting every impediment in the way in order to prevent him from being able to do what the British public expressed was their wish during the referendum, and it's very sad that you know that there are even plans afoot to table a motion of no confidence in him immediately that Parliament opens after he's taken his new office. So he might end up being Prime Minister for a day if things go really, really badly. I would hope that even though these politicians are so venal and petty, that they would at least recognise that blowing Boris out after just a day would be an absolute tragedy from the point of view of our nation, just purely from the point of view of the things that are not just Brexit, but other developments like the situation in the Gulf, where we are where we seem to be being inexorably drawn towards some kind of military confrontation with Iran. And so we could end up in a situation if they have a table of a motion of no confidence, that Boris Johnson could lose his prime ministership after just a day. And then we might find ourselves at war with Iran with nobody actually leading the country, which would be an absolutely diabolical situation. But there we are.
That's what they're pushing us to, isn't
it?
Horizon. That is what they seem to be pushing us towards. As you say, we've got all these other important things that are going on. I just wanted to say, that's a good point I think you make there. That the fact that he is resigning over a personal difference with Boris Johnson, but if he thought he was any good at his job, he would be saying, "Hey, I'm good at my job. You can't afford to get rid of me." So basically, by doing that, he's admitting that he's absolutely rubbish at his job. He hasn't done his job for the good of the country. He's just done his job to try and prevent people from leaving the EU. This is an admission that he didn't do his job to the best of his ability, I think. Which is,
I think if he actually believed that he was of great value in the role that he's been fulfilling, then he would use that as leverage over Boris Johnson to try and, if he disagrees with what Boris Johnson's intending to do, he would use that as leverage in order to moderate what Boris is aiming to do. But obviously he doesn't have such great faith in his own value that he's prepared to attempt to use it as leverage and wants to just walk away, which is very, very sad.
And also the BBC, as I say, they're bigging him up and saying what a wonderful character he is. So, of course, instantly you think, well, he can't be. He's got to be a bad guy if the BBC love him so much. But, yeah, you were mentioning the Iranian tanker situation that we're in at the moment. I mean, that's pretty serious, but I mean, it was expected. We were expecting Iran to do some kind of retaliation for Britain impounding their oil tanker. And of course they have. They've impounded a British tanker. And it does look to me as if the British tanker did actually go into Iranian waters. I don't know if that was after the Iranians boarded it or before, because they're saying it was before. You can see on the map that the ship suddenly makes a turning north, goes quite some way into Iranian water, and then it turns and heads for Iran, basically. So I think maybe they did go into Iranian water, in which case it was quite legal for them to board them and do that. Perhaps maybe under better situation, they wouldn't have done so. They would have just, made them aware of the fact they'd gone into international water, gone into Iranian waters. But because of the way that the situation is, they've taken the ship. I mean, it is quite a serious situation in that strait there, I think, Max.
Yeah, I think the key phrase that you just used there is that we were expecting it. You and I were expecting it. And I think any well, a significant number, a significant proportion of the British people, if they were questioned on this subject, that they would have been expecting it as well. And so one of the key questions we have to ask is why none of our government ministers were expecting it, why we only had one warship in the Gulf when there is a grave danger that British tankers were going to be hijacked by the Iranians. Because, you know, first of all, we hijacked one of their oil tankers on its way to Syria as it was going through the Straits of Gibraltar. Now, okay, our government have claimed that it was done legitimately because the Iranians were trying to break the sanctions that have been imposed on Syria. But the Iranian government obviously reacted in a way which indicated they didn't think that it was illegal what they were doing, that they felt that it was an act of piracy, that what had happened by I think it was the Gibraltar Navy and British Royal Marines, what we'd done, and they vowed to retaliate. And so, if we were expecting it, why wasn't anybody else expecting it? And it just occurs to me that our government ministers can't possibly be so stupid that they weren't expecting it. You know, in view of the fact that there had been other incidents where the Iranian gunboats had been suspected of planting limpet mines on ships as they were going through the Straits of Hormuz, this kind of thing. When all this was happening, why wasn't it expected? Why were British warships not sent to the Gulf immediately in order to prevent this kind of thing from happening? Why weren't British ships instructed to sort of weigh anchor just outside of the Gulf until there were groups of, say, six of them, and then for them to go through in a group of six with a warship accompanying them, in which case they could have all got through and then they could have all been escorted back out again a bit later on. You know, these would have been the kind of things that should have been done by a nation that was aiming to defend itself, but also aiming to prevent this situation from becoming worse than it actually is. And the fact that there seems to be, I mean, we've had during the course of this last week, we've had retired naval officers stating their absolute amazement that these kind of precautions weren't taken. And so the question we have to ask ourselves is why were our government ministers not taking these precautions? Why were they seemingly offering up these oil tankers on a plate for the Iranians to take in order to further inflame and exacerbate this situation? That's what it seems has happened here, that these ships have been just allowed to run the gauntlet of the of an Iranian unofficial blockade, inviting the Iranians to actually retaliate in the way that they're threatened, almost as if our government actually wanted the Iranians to retaliate so that the situation can be ratcheted up one more notch towards a major confrontation. And what we've got to recognise is, as a backdrop to all of this, is the undying enmity of the Israeli government towards the Iranians, the fact that they desperately want there to be regime change in Iran, the fact that they desperately want some kind of excuse and pretext so that the Americans can begin a military assault upon Iran in order to bring about that regime change. And it all looks rather suspicious to me. That's really my sort of deduction on this matter.
Do you think that, you know, that could actually be calculated? Because it could also just be arrogance. It could be that the British government was just so arrogant that they didn't believe that their ships were in any danger at all, that the Iranians just wouldn't dare take a British ship. They wouldn't dare have the audacity to impound a British ship. I mean, it could be that there was arrogance there, but something that really, sort of stops me from thinking that is the fact that they were offered help. I believe they were offered an escort from American warships, and they turned it down. And they said, oh, we'll have that later or something, in a few weeks' time or something like that. I do believe they actually turned down an escort at one stage, which does tend to imply that they were wanting this to happen. Now, has there been a second ship impounded, do you know, or just this one ship? British one.
There was a ship. There was a second ship that was initially taken in by the Iranians, but then after an inspection of the ship, it was allowed to leave. But this was a ship that I think it turned out was not. I can't think quite what the technical situation was, but the ship that's been held is one which is British owned, and the other one I think was registered in Britain but not British owned. I think something of that sort was the situation, and that was the one that was allowed to eventually pass through. So I think that there is a definite targeting of British ships by the Iranians, and the more British the ship, the more likely it would be to be to be harassed by the Iranians. But it's again, you see, we had a situation where there was in place a treaty between the Iranians and between the Americans and the European Union, which enabled the Iranians to continue to develop nuclear power for peaceful purposes. Donald Trump has, in my view, rather ill-advisedly has disavowed that treaty, and as a result of that, we have a situation where the Iranians are now in flagrant breach of that treaty, and are virtually boasting about it, and boasting about the fact that they're now generating more almost military grade plutonium in their various facilities. And so it's kind of a game of brinkmanship, and it's a sort of game of brinkmanship that very often ends in tears. And I think that it's all very well and good engaging that kind of brinkmanship that might end in tears if you are well prepared for it to end in tears, because, you know, you've got the stronger side and you can make sure that you don't come off second best. But I think as far as our Navy is concerned, our Navy has been reduced and reduced and reduced. There's been defense spending cuts after defense spending cuts after defense spending cuts over the decades. And I think we're down in terms of naval ships down to something like about 80 ships now. Whereas if you went back to say 1890, the British Navy had over 1,000 ships. The policy that was pursued by the British government in the early part of the last century was that the number of battleships that the Royal Navy had to exceed the number of the next two strongest nations added together. And so that was the extent of British naval power at the beginning of the 20th century. And here we are 100 years later, where we've got 80 ships, many of which are just very small minesweepers and motor torpedo boats and things of that sort, with very, very few large ships. We don't currently have an aircraft carrier that's actually commissioned. We've got an aircraft carrier that's been built and it's undergoing testing prior to being commissioned, but it's not yet been commissioned. Our Navy seems to be composed of frigates and destroyers, which are not particularly large, not particularly impressive looking. And, one has to wonder, quite what they are going to be capable of doing. I think that the Type 45 destroyer HMS Duncan that's been dispatched has got just a small 4.5-inch gun on the front. The same goes for the HMS Montrose, which is a Type 23 frigate that's already in the Gulf. These ships both have surface-to-surface missiles that are like anti-ship missiles, but they don't have that many of those missiles. So I don't know how accurate these missiles are. I don't think we've actually ever seen these kind of missiles used actually in an actual war situation. So it will be interesting to see how they perform if it comes to that. When you consider the armament that battleships carried in the past, the British Navy at the moment seems very small and not particularly threatening. And I think that you know, may well be the way in which the Iranians perceive it. Of course, the British Navy is still, even in that depleted state, still several times larger than the Iranian Navy. So I don't think there's any sort of problems there. But we could have a situation where the Iranians fire surface-to-surface missiles from the mainland, which they possibly could do, which would then be able to reach the warships that are in the Gulf. And so we've got a fairly small navy in a quite a precarious situation. And I think even with the US naval ships coming into play, they would be hard put to hold their own, I think, if there was a concerted amount of fire from Iranian artillery and also Iranian surface-to-surface missiles from the mainland. And so it isn't a scenario where there would be any easy way of settling the matter, I don't think. And I think that it's the sort of situation where both sides could end up coming away with a bloody nose.
That is really shocking to think that, you know, Britain used to rule the waves. Britannia ruled the waves. British sea power was world renowned. And now we're down to just 80 ships within a century. I mean, I'm just really shocked at that. I didn't realise that our Navy was in such a depleted condition to not even have an aircraft carrier. This is just unbelievable. I wasn't actually aware of this, Max. I mean, this is, this is quite shocking to me. And also you've got to think that strait there, all the oil tankers in the world, pretty much, they have to pass through that strait. And all along that coast there, that's Iran. That is the Iranian coastline there. So they're going to be armed to the teeth. And you're not going to be able to get that many, war vessels from Britain there. I think the Iranians actually have the, they have the stronger hand there because it's their seaway. It's their waters. It's Iranian waters. It's not international waters that are there. So legally they can do what they like with their, with their little bit. Plus, as I say, they're going to be armed to the teeth all along the shoreline there. So I think, pride comes before a fall. And I think there is an essence of arrogance here as well in Britain, thinking that she can just get away with doing this. And also because the fact that Iran is not a part of the EU, it's nothing to do with the EU, to say, well, we're going to impound your tanker because it's breaking European Union sanctions. That's not legal to do that because Iran is not a part of the European Union. Iran can do whatever it likes with Syria. It's not bound by any laws. It's not bound by any treaties other than the treaties and the laws that it has made between itself and Syria and anything that it has signed up to at the UN. It's like when Elton John complains that his homosexual film has been censored in Russia and just calls it petty local laws and thinks that somehow he should be above the law and his movie should be allowed to be seen there because it can be seen in British cinemas. And it's the same thing here. It's Britain and the European Union saying, well, you have to obey our laws, even though it's not their laws. It's incredible arrogance here. And I do think, pride comes before a fall. And if there was to be a military situation there, I don't think America and Britain are going to come off very well at all. Plus, you've got Israel there. Of course, they're going to have all their weapons trained on Israel if someone attacks them. It's very, very reckless to be doing what they are doing. But then again, I mean, you have to look back and think, look at the North Korea situation a while back, and that was supposed to be very reckless with the language that Trump was using and that Kim was using, and yet through that reckless behaviour, they managed to come to some kind of treaty. And I know that Donald Trump has said that, he does want to have a treaty with Iran, and so maybe this is just, this is all a bit of willy waving, and eventually they might come to some kind of agreement, but. It is worrying for the rest of us, and I guess it must also be worrying for the oil companies and the people that use that corridor. And perhaps that would end up putting the price up on oil, which obviously the oil companies aren't going to be too upset about. I mean, it could cause there to be an increase in trade. So we just have to see what happens. But as we say, it was expected. We were expecting this. So why wasn't the British government expecting it. Do you want to say anything else on that, Max, or do you want to move on to this Bank of England thing?
No, we can move on to the Bank of England, yeah.
Yeah, well, tell us what's happening here, because I wasn't aware of this until we actually were comparing show notes for today. The governor of the Bank of England is being replaced by an Indian or something, you were telling me.
Well, I think Mark Carney, who is the current governor of the Bank of England, who is Canadian, his term of office is going to be coming to an end later on this year. And I think that this article, which I picked out of the Financial Mail on Sunday, is perhaps a bit of kite flying on the part of the authorities, just to see what kind of reaction there would be. But the announcement was that the question that was asked in the article in the Mail was whether Raghuram Rajan, who was a former governor of the Reserve Bank of India, whether he would be appointed to replace Mark Carney as governor of the Bank of England. And I just think that this is a continuation of the kind of deplorable way in which we in this country seem to be replacing homegrown people with foreigners who may well be very well qualified for the jobs that they come over and that they take. And my opinion on this is exactly the same regarding Mark Carney as it is with regard to Rajan fellow. It's one would have thought that the interests of this country would be best served by having a British person as the head of the Bank of England. The reason for this is that it means that the expertise that is built up by that individual over their period of office is retained within this country and is there to as a resource for any incoming new Bank of England governor to take their place. And the very fact that we're considering taking on somebody else who not only is another foreigner but is an even more remote foreigner than the current incumbent as far as the Bank of England is concerned. And it was stated in the Mail that the theory goes that Indian-born Rajan would be the perfect candidate to promote a global Britain after Brexit. Oh, you just can't make it up, can you? And this is a gripe, I suppose, that I've had over a number of years with successive managers of the England football team and things of this sort, where instead of there being a homegrown person in that role, we find somebody else from abroad and bring them in on the basis that they are the best qualified person for the job. But I think if we were talking about a position that is in private commerce or industry or something of that sort, then that would be one thing. But where we're dealing with somebody who is the leader of a national team or in this case, the head of the Bank of England, which is a very important position, then those kind of positions ought to be reserved for people who are British, and it should be British bankers that do it, people who understand the banking culture in this country right from the get-go and who can be relied upon to have loyalties that are entirely with the UK and not perhaps divided by virtue of the fact that they come from a completely different part of the world. And if you think about it, somebody who comes in as a foreigner and becomes the governor of the Bank of England will, over the course of the period in which that they're employed in that capacity, they will be responsible for shaping fiscal policy in this country. They will be responsible for designing the systems that we have within our banking system to react to various crises. And all that kind of insider knowledge is the kind of insider knowledge that we would only want somebody whose commitment to our country is unqualified. We would only want a person of that sort to actually have that kind of information. Because if you think about it, and I'm not trying to cast aspersions on Raghuram Rajan at all, neither am I trying to cast aspersions on Mark Carney, but where are they going to go when they leave? Are they going to go and be the head of a private organization? Are they going to become the head of some other investment institution where they're then going to use the knowledge, the insider knowledge that they would have gained in their during their term as the governor of the Bank of England, to be able to use that for the profit of an overseas private company at the expense of the British people and the British economy, because they're the kind of they're the kind of dangers that this kind of thing opens up. You know, it would be amazing, you know, but following the same logic in terms of the appointment of these individuals would be the logic of appointing a foreign admiral to be the admiral of the fleet as far as Britain is concerned, or to appoint a foreign general as the head of the British Armed Forces. Now, if you just like cast your mind back to the end of the Second World War, what sort of response would you have had if Erwin Rommel had been appointed the commander of the British army in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, or somebody equivalent to him? You know, it's something which would have just been regarded as inconceivable. It couldn't possibly have happened, no matter how gifted a general that person might be. You know, it would, from a political perspective, just be totally unconscionable, because we would then be placing the defence of our country in the hands of somebody who would not be committed to the defence of our people, and who could go away at the end of their period of tenure and use the information that they've gleaned in terms of the way in which our army operates, or the way in which our navy operates, so that our army and our navy could be defeated on the field of battle at some point in the future. So that kind of thing would just never be considered. But the same thing applies with the governor of the Bank of England. Whoever comes in and whoever is has a term of office as the governor of the Bank of England will learn all sorts of insider knowledge, will have knowledge of our systems, will be instrumental in constructing those systems and designing those systems. And, you know, who knows, if that person has got no real loyalty to Britain, has got no real loyalty to the British people, they could have their eyes on a fabulous job that could be offered to them at some point when they've left their term of office as governor of the Bank of England, and they could already be building those systems with loopholes in them, with weaknesses in them, so that at some future date, when they have a fat salary and are employed by some foreign bank, that they could then use that insider information to speculate and to produce vast profits for their own benefit, but for the at the detriment of our people, and to the detriment of our nation. You know, these sort of things could happen. So we really ought to have a British person as the governor of the Bank of England, just in the same way that we should have a British person appointed to lead our army and a British person appointed to lead our navy, and all of the top jobs in any public body within this country, those top jobs ought to be occupied by British people whose commitment to our nation and commitment to the well-being of our people is uncompromising.
It's like all common sense has to be sacrificed on the altar of political correctness and diversity. I was reading the other day complaints about the fact that all the leaders of the World Bank had all been white men. Of course, probably a lot of them are actually Jews, but according to the press, that was all white men. And they were saying, isn't it about time we had some black leaders of banks and Indian leaders of banks? And, you know, I can recall reading just a little short while back about the first African National Bank that was actually run by purebred Africans, and they robbed the bank. They stole all the money from the bank. They ended up giving out loans to themselves, giving out loans to the people that were in government that they just never paid back, and they crashed the bank. They basically robbed the bank. And that's the sort of thing that could end up happening if you end up putting a black guy in charge of the bank in Britain. But nobody thinks about that, and nobody thinks about the loyalty. They just think, well, it would be so much better, so much more global and so progressive if we had an Indian guy. running the bank. It was the same as when we had the leadership election for the Tory party and we had Sajid Javid there. And the BBC was saying, oh, wouldn't that be wonderful? Wouldn't it be wonderful if we had Sajid Javid leading the country? And when, I forget which one of the Conservative contenders it was that was being interviewed by Andrew Marr, his first question was, don't you think it would be better to have the son of a Pakistani bus driver as Prime Minister? And he didn't back that up with any reason for why it would be better to have a Pakistani leading the country rather than someone that was British. Just the fact that it's somebody who is not white, that's enough. That's enough of a qualification to put somebody into any position, according to the media and the narrative that we see. And that's what we see here. That's why they're so pleased about this. That's why they think it's wonderful that we should have an Indian leading the Bank of England. It's just simply because he's an Indian. I bet there was no mention of his qualifications in that article, Max. Was there any mention of his qualifications, or were they just cooing over the fact that he was an Indian?
They were discussing his educational qualifications, and he mentioned that he got a PhD in finance, and he made a little bit of joke about it on the basis that it's normally expected if you go into a politically appointed position of this sort that's to do with banking that you would have a degree in economics, but in fact, you know, his degree is in finance, which is not necessarily a million miles away, and the sort of thing that you'd expect. And as I say, I think in this case, it's not really a matter of suggesting that he is an unsuitable person from the point of view of his qualifications or anything of that sort. It's just really a matter of saying that. You know, he isn't British. He has been the head of the Reserve Bank of India, and presumably once he's done a stint as the as the governor of the Bank of England, should he ever be appointed, then he would go on to then head up some other bank somewhere else. And it's a career position. I can remember during my career, there would often be people who would be brought into the various companies that I worked for who would appear to be kind of whiz kid managers who were not homegrown by the various companies concerned. They were people who were headhunted from other competitor companies, and they would come in and they would be very dynamic, and they would make all sorts of sweeping changes and really shake the organization up a bit. And initially everything would seem to be going absolutely hunky-dory, and then these people would leave and they would move on before the fruits of their labor had actually fully come home to roost. And then, of course, once they'd left, everything then started to fall apart, and all sorts of strategic miscalculations that they'd made would suddenly come to would become apparent. And but by then it was too late, because they'd come in, they had been headhunted, and so they would have joined the company with a golden hello, and then they would have left before the excrement hit the revolving blades, and they would accept a golden handshake as they left. And so from their point of view, personally, they really couldn't lose, because they just had so much money lavished upon them because of this reputation they have as being a kind of international high flyer. But then they would then move on, leaving the homegrown people who had started off as, you know, tea boy and had gradually worked their way up to a management position, to leave those people who were committed to the company and who were totally immersed in the culture of the company to pick up the pieces and try and put right everything else, the sort of vandalism that had taken place whilst one of these high flyers was in. Now, and again, I'm not suggesting that Mark Carney or that Raghuram Rajan is the kind of person who would wreak that kind of devastation. But what I'm saying is that by employing this kind of policy where we employ people who are seen as being international high flyers, employing them in these kind of situations, we are gravitating towards the kind of situation where those kind of abuses can take place, and not just take place in one company, but where those kind of abuses can take place in a government department or a very important position, such as the Bank of England. And we really ought to have grown wise to this kind of thing, and we really ought to have a far more responsible and well thought through strategy in terms of ensuring the continuity of the Bank of England, and to make sure that the Bank of England continues to serve the well-being of our people, rather than it being a career playground for international banking executives.
Yeah, I think this is really a problem that's inherent in capitalism when you think about it. You've got people that are educated at our universities, and all the information that they're taught, it's all built on the knowledge that people in Britain have discovered before, the whole of science, the whole of medicine, everything like that. They get educated at the university, and then they move off to another country, and all that knowledge and all that education gets used somewhere else. Particularly, we have that problem with doctors and nurses, and they'll go off and they'll go and work in America, or they'll go and work in Australia, where they get a higher pay, and we'll end up with African nurses that are educated to a substandard level, and African doctors that are responsible for 70% of the gross incompetence cases that happen in the NHS, whereas we've got fantastic resources for actually teaching medicine here in Britain. And another thing that I think is also linked to this is the selling of our technology to the rest of the world. We end up working on things here in Britain, again, which is built up on the foundations of all the knowledge and all the discoveries that went on before. We come out with a discovery, and straight away it gets sold to another country, and you end up with China making all the computers, even though it was Britain that actually invented the computer. And we end up selling them military hardware. We end up selling military hardware to countries in Africa, Saudi Arabia, Iran. We end up selling these people this defensive equipment that we've ended up developing for ourselves. I mean, the Africans, they never got even further than a spear, let alone using a gun. And then suddenly these countries then become our enemy, and they've got all this technology that we've given them. And it's the same with medical advances that really should have just been used for our own people. We end up giving them all away in Africa, and we end up with them suddenly increasing from, I think, 100 million to over 1 billion, coming up for 2 billion people within 100 years, and eating up all the resources of the earth, not being able to actually even provide enough resources for themselves, so they come flooding into our countries to eat up our resources. And I think the root of all of it is this idea of international capitalism, where you make the absolute most that you can out of the people around you, and everybody is expected to act as an individual and to make the most profit that they can from everybody that is around them, regardless of the fact that if it wasn't for those people around them, they would have nothing. If it wasn't for the people that came before us, we would have nothing. If you look around wherever you are now, and you look around the room, everything was produced by other people. It was all inventions that were thought up by people in the past. It's all intellectual property that actually belongs to us. What right have we got to then sell that intellectual property, sell what we have made from that intellectual property to anybody else other than the descendants of the people that created it in the first place? It's a real big issue with me, and it comes down to this idea of rights and duties, this idea that we're born with the right to take this or the right to have that. It's a nonsense. We're not born with rights, we're born with duties, because from the minute we're born, everything is provided for us, absolutely everything, from mother's milk onwards, it's all provided for us. And when you look at that, you don't think, I deserve all of this, it's my right to take even more. You think, well, it's my duty to pay these people back in some way. How could I possibly pay my parents back? Well, you can pay your parents back by giving them grandchildren, and you can pay back your ancestors by improving the world for your descendants and for their descendants. And that's the way that our ancestors did things. That's why they took 100 years building cathedrals, building things. And that's why they went out and conquered America and Australia, so they could provide for their descendants, for their posterity. It wasn't so that they could take everything that they possibly could from one another once they were there. This idea is capitalism. I mean, a lot of the time we will talk and we will run down communism. Capitalism is just as dangerous. This mindset is just as dangerous. And it's that mindset that leads to the British government saying, well, wouldn't it be great if we got an Indian Indian guy over to be the governor of the Bank of England? And as you say, Max, he will then take everything that he learns from there. He will then take that back to India or wherever else that he goes. He'll have all that insider information and he will be able to make use of what he learned at the Bank of England from the people that were there before him, all the British people that have worked there at the Bank of England and all the financial ideas that they've had. He will have access to all of that and he'll take all that intellectual property and it will be taken from us and it will go to somebody else. And that's seen as perfectly fine because it's your right to do that. It's your right to take what you can from the community. And that's not true. It's not your right to do that. And I think that is central to so many of the problems that we face is this idea that it's just your right to take everything. Do you understand what I mean there, Max?
Yeah, I understand completely. And in fact, it was interesting that a bit earlier on this week, I can't remember exactly where, there was somebody who was a spokesperson, I think it was, for this sort of climate emergency movement, who was talking about the desire to move away from the capitalist model where there is this never-ending drive for increased profits each year, and they were saying that the objective shouldn't necessarily be that we have increased profits, and we shouldn't have swelling the GDP as being that the primary aim of our society. What we should have is making our society and our civilization sustainable should be the key thing. And so really what they were saying there is that this mammonistic urge to earn greater and greater profits all the time under capitalism should be suspended in order to ensure the survival of our planet. And I thought that's perfectly logical position to take. I just thought it was rather sad, though, that those same people wouldn't have regarded the suspension of capitalism as being justified if it was to ensure the survival of our race. But the principle is exactly the same. It's one whereby we need to have a society where the primary motivating factor, the primary goal, the thing that is the upon which everything else hinges has got to be something more than just money and profits. It's got to be people, and we've got to start thinking of ourselves as a people and thinking about our peoplehood as having intrinsic value in itself rather than us being slaves to ever increasing profits, which brings upon us year after year after year all of these same sort of crises one after the other. And now we're facing the climate emergency, and we're in a situation where the society that we have is seen as being unsustainable.
The only way you can have a sustainable way of doing things is to do it nationally. You can't do it internationally. It's like if you're on a farm, you try to be sustainable, you sustain your household. You don't look at, well, how can we sustain everybody else's household? You look at, well, how do we sustain our household? That's the way we do things first. And that's not the way that the climate change movement is doing things. They're not saying, right, well, we need to make Britain self-sustainable. We need to look after the British people working for British people, British jobs for British people, British steel. We want all of that so that we're providing for ourselves. They don't think like that. They say, right, well, we have to be providing for China. We have to be putting in laws in Britain so that we can send tax money to India. We need to be cutting back on plastic in Britain because there's a plastic problem in the oceans in China. You know, all these crazy ideas, when the only way that you can really do these things is to put the nationhood at the heart. Well, as you were saying there, Max, with peoplehood needs to be at the center of everything. The nation needs to be at the center of everything. Everything needs to be looked at as is this good for the nation? You can't say, is it good for the world? Because if you're saying, is it good for the world, you're saying, is it good for somebody else? You're not saying, is it good for you? And if you look at that from the individual level, nobody else is going to look out for you. No, you know, no, you can't say, I'm going to look out for everybody else, because you're not looking out for yourself. Then you would give everything away before you took anything for yourself. You have to go out and work to provide food for yourself, to provide a roof over your head. The nation has to work for itself. It can't, say that it's working for everybody else. And this ties in with this, you know, this racist idea. It's racist to actually put your own nation first. It's common sense. It's living to put yourself first. And I just want to add another point there. We were talking about this, this ever expanding economy, ever expanding. We've got to keep getting more and more and more profits. I mean, that's driven by usury because there isn't enough cash within circulation to pay off the debt of the interest. So it has to continually grow and grow and grow and grow, which is obviously unsustainable. It has to collapse. And the reason for that, the root of that, is the fact that when they create money and when they publish it into circulation, they don't publish the interest as well. That interest is always extra. If somebody borrows £10 and that £10 goes into circulation and they have to pay back, say, £15, there is no other £5 in circulation. The only way there can be another £5 in circulation is if somebody else takes out another debt for £10, and then you've got that extra £5 there, but then you've got another £15 that needs to be found in order to pay back both that second debt, if you see what I mean. So you end up with a continually expanding money supply, which causes the inflation, which causes all the house prices to go up, and it causes people to lose money, and it causes us to be like on a treadmill, furiously running on a treadmill like a hamster all the time. We're never actually getting anywhere because we're always having to pay back this inflation, and all of this is tied together with these ideas that are totally unnatural. Usury is totally unnatural. Thinking you have rights and not duties, that's totally unnatural. Taking everything you can from the environment without any thought for the later generations, that is totally unnatural. We have a completely unnatural way of thinking, which is reinforced with what we see on the television, in the movies, what the kids are being taught at school now. And it's all aimed at just weakening white people. But I do think it harms these other races as well. I mean, usury and capitalism and all of this stuff, the harm it causes in India, in Africa, and all of it. You know, we need to stand against all of it, I think, Max.
Yeah, that's right. And the never-ending desire for increased profits that comes from capitalism is one of the drivers that's allowing world population growth to continue unabated. The more people that there are within an economy, the greater the gross domestic product, and so therefore the greater the economic growth appears to be on paper, albeit that there may be a disproportionately greater amount of people sharing a not so disproportionately increased amount of production. So increasing GDP doesn't necessarily mean that individual people are better off. It just means that the numbers at the bottom line look bigger, and the politicians can be pleased with themselves that they're producing economic growth. I mean, one of the things that as you were talking there that occurred to, that I can recall was many years ago when there was discussion about the finite nature of natural resources and how the steel industry in this country was being closed down because we couldn't find enough steel, enough iron ore that was able to be mined in an economic way in order to continue the steel industry. And it just occurred to me that a good economic strategy might be in certain areas would be to collect together the unwanted waste. And I'm not really here talking about us collecting loads and loads of plastic and stuff. I was thinking of at the time was steel, because there are lots of cars that reach the end of their working lifetime and they get crushed down and broken down, etc. But when you live in a world where there are finite resources, it's having the raw material or having the recycled material that actually is going to provide you with wealth, because then you don't have to find the ore in order to make steel. And so if instead of when we have large ships that reach the end of their lifetime, instead of selling those ships off to little communities in Indonesia, where those ships are then transported round by sea, sort of pulled round there by tugs, and are then run aground on the beaches of Indonesia, and you then have, there are like whole villages in Indonesia that spend all of their time just dismantling the steel hulls of old ships and then recycling the steel. And it just occurred to me, you know, many, many years ago that that was something that could be done quite profitably in this country. And the steel industry that we had could have continued, not with new steel made from iron ore, but with old recycled steel. Because the more of the old steel we have, you know, if you have a situation where eventually all of the iron ore runs out all over the world, the country that's got the most scrap steel is going to be the country that's going to be the one that comes out on top and that has the and that benefits the most. It just disappointed me a couple of times throughout my lifetime when my attention has been brought to the fact that so many grand old ships, I think, you know, one of the old sort of Queen Marys or something was, and quite a lot of the old battleships and aircraft carriers that used to form part of our fleet in years gone by, these great ships were towed around to Southeast Asia, where there were then communities there that obviously would break up those ships into steel more cheaply than people perhaps would have wanted to do it in Tyneside or somewhere like that. But why shouldn't the hulls of those ships have been taken back to the same shipyards from which they were commissioned, so that the communities there could break them up, so that the local steel industries could recycle the steel and then carry on producing ships? That would have been the way to have done things. But, you know, we've now moved so far away from that now that, you know, all that seems like a sort of a distant possibility. But these are things, as the climate emergency kind of situation evolves and people become more and more alert to the fact that, you know, we do live in a world of finite resources, that that kind of thinking is going to become more and more valuable in the future.
Well, it would provide work as well. I mean, this idea that we live with finite resources, that the climate change camp people talk about, I mean, this is the central point of nationalism. We have finite resources and we have a finite territory. And if you bring other people into that territory, they are then competitors for those resources. They're not collaborators in producing more. They're competitors. They're taking those resources away from us. And just to make a point there, where you were talking about the population explosion there and the increase in the GDP. Another part of that is when they look at the population, they look at them as economic units. And if you have a certain amount of people in the population, then the bank or the government can say, well, we've got certain amount of people in our population. It's growing all the time. Each one of these people is an economic unit. Each one of these economic units can generate X amount of pounds. Therefore, we can borrow X amount of pounds. And I think that's partially why there is this drive to keep on immigration coming into Britain, because they can say, well, look, each of these people represent an economic unit, a certain amount of money, which means that we can borrow more money because it's going to be paid back by them. We can generate this money. So they end up borrowing more money and you get more inflation. But the problem then is that they work out this average of these people that they're going to pay it back, and they don't pay it back. A lot of people just don't pay this money back. And this is the problem that they've run into in Africa when they loan out this money, the World Bank loans out this money to these African nations, and they're just not capable of paying it back. They take out a loan and they don't pay it back. And the country ends up looking like Zimbabwe. And then we import these same people into our countries and same problem happens again. They don't pay their money back. But on the books, it looks good because you've got X amount of people. They've made X amount of loans or whatever it is. They can bundle up those loans into some other kind of financial instrument, use it as a security on something else. And of course, this is what happened in America that caused the big crash back in 2008, was giving out all these mortgages to these black families that didn't have a hope in hell of actually paying this mortgage back. And all those bundled up financial instruments containing those mortgages, they weren't worth the paper they were written on. And they caused this huge crash to happen. So again, that's another part that is tied in with this. And that's one of the reasons why they say, well, immigration is great because it causes this big boost to the economy, but only on paper. Only on paper, and only because they see all people, all human beings, as being the same, whereas people with a higher IQ, particularly white people, are going to be more productive than people with a lower IQ. And you're also going to be able to rely on people with a higher IQ to pay their debts, rather than just to borrow a load of money and then just not pay it back, which is what's happened in Africa. Well, I think that's been a great conversation today, Max. We've gone in quite deeply there into a lot of subjects. That was really good.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next Monday with more Aryan Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you all have a great week ahead of you.
To the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.